ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Main engine start.
I remember the day so clearly.
One left off.
Roger, Challenger. Obviously a major malfunction.
I ran outside as fast as I could and looked up in the sky.
Couldn't believe it. It had exploded.
I'm science reporter Fiona Pepper.
And I'm Dr. Carl.
We're going to tell you the story of Challenger.
Challenger Legacy. Search for Science Friction wherever you get your podcasts.
Or on the ABC Listen app.
What if, as now looks certain, the Reserve Bank starts increasing interest rates next Tuesday after a year of successive cuts? That first initial hike would cost a typical borrower on a $600,000 mortgage an extra $90 a month. The next, another $90. If there are three, the cost would climb to $270 a month. Over an entire year, an extra $3,200. It'd force some of us to tighten our belts, which would be what the Reserve Bank was trying to achieve, and there's no telling where it would stop. With this week's shocking inflation update showing prices climbing at an annual rate of 3.8%, Australia looks set to become one of the first countries in the world to lift rates in an attempt to smother spending, in an admission that it might have cut too soon, too far. Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and my guest this week, someone who has been unnervingly prescient throughout the past year in outlining the options in front of the Reserve Bank, David Bassanese, who's Chief Economist and Interest Rate Specialist at Beta Shares and has worked for Bankers Trust, the Macquarie Bank and the Commonwealth Treasury. And Miriam Robin, senior writer for the Australian Financial Review, whose eyes are firmly fixed on the behaviour of Australian businesses and business leaders. Welcome, David, and welcome back, Miriam.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for having us.
David, I reckon you've been right more than most people who try to predict how the Reserve Bank will read things over the past year or so. How do you think it's going to read this week's alarmingly large inflation figure for the year to December, 3.8%?
Yeah, look, I think it's going to read it as suggesting, you know, maybe one cut too many last year, as you suggested. I mean, what we've seen is the economy has bounced back, demand has picked up, but we're starting to see pricing pressure re-emerge. So we had a high, you know, September quarter inflation reading, and the December quarter one was also on the high side. So I guess they'll probably decide they've got to, you know, tighten the reins a little bit and slow growth to ensure that pricing pressure does come back down again.
3.8% is well above their 2-3% target band. If you look underneath the figures, is the pace of prices picking up or slowing down?
Look, it's probably picked up over the second half of the year. Now, what economists can look at, I mean, the headline number that you've mentioned, you know, has been distorted by the electricity subsidies over the past year. So a big focus for economists at the moment is what's called the trimmed mean. It's like a more of an underlying measure of inflation. It strips out some of the more volatile price increases, both on the upside and the downside. And look, and just quickly, the quarterly increase for that was 0.9% in the December quarter, down only marginally from the 1% that we got in the September quarter.
If you multiply 0.9 by 4, yeah, you've got a very large increase.
Closer to 4%. Yeah, so basically underlying inflation running at a 4% annualised pace in the second half of last year, you know, well above the RBA's target, hence why they probably think they need to, tighten things up a little bit with a rate hike.
Is it because we're very keen to spend, which could be one of the explanations, or might it be because the economy isn't good at producing the things we want without pushing prices higher? It's operating near capacity. Andrew Houser, the deputy governor of the Reserve Bank, said he suspected it might be capacity constraints in an interview with the ABC's business editor, Michael Yander, at the beginning of the year.
firms are operating at reasonably high capacity. That's a good thing. It means that there aren't loads of spare resources, people out of work lying around. But it does also mean that there may be less scope to expand production without inflation also picking up. If that were to be the scenario behind the pickup in inflation, that actually we're bumping against the bumpers, we could be seeing a less optimistic profile for interest rates. At the moment, we don't know which of those scenarios is more likely, and that will be a dominant discussion for the board in February.
What are these figures telling the bank, David, that we're spending too much and pushing up prices, or that labour and other things are becoming hard to get, which is pushing up prices?
What these numbers do show is there is an imbalance between demand and supply. I mean, demand is firm relative to available supply. And so what we get today is the pricing, you know, data. Well, what we've got this week from the Bureau of Stats is the pricing data. So that is evidence of demand running ahead of supply. But as you point out, the issue at the moment is the level of demand is very high relative to supply. So it means that the pace of demand doesn't have to be all that strong to press up against a capacity constraint. So people, if you look at overall consumer spending in like the national accounts, you know, it's running at say a 2 to 3% pace. So consumer spending is sort of in line with the long run average at the moment. You wouldn't say it's super strong, but given we're at capacity constraints, you know, if you look at the low level of unemployment, the high operating capacity that the businesses are operating in, even that is maybe at the moment a little bit too strong. That's the challenge.
What's the sense you're getting from business leaders, Miriam, that we're spending big time and pushing up prices? They'd like that. Or that unemployment is so low they can't get workers and that's pushing up prices and they probably wouldn't like that.
Yeah, well, look, I'll answer this two ways. So first, statistically, NAB put out a business survey around capacity utilization this week, and that actually found businesses were utilizing their productive capacity was above long-run averages in most of the industries that it tracks. So that's sort of the statistical answer to that is like, yeah, they are hitting up those capacity constraints. But I think anecdotally, I have not come across a small business since the global financial crisis, really, that isn't having trouble finding staff and workers, particularly in low-skilled industries. Now, you know, there's always an answer to how do you get more workers, which is you can raise what you're paying and then you'll probably attract more. But of course, if you do that, then you might have those workers pushing up inflation or you might have to raise your prices to recoup those wages. So I think there is, quite a long-term capacity issue that I think has really been building for several years.
Is what's at issue, David, what's called NAIRU, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment? It used to be called the natural rate of unemployment or full employment. The idea is you need some unemployment to stop wages going through the roof in the industries in which people happen to be scarce, and that natural rate, well, we used to think it was 5%, we now think it's lower, but it might be above where unemployment is now, above 4.1%, that we might need to push up unemployment, as awful as that sounds, to contain inflation.
Look, there's probably an element of truth to that. I mean, the RBA has characterised the labour market in recent months as a little bit tight, a little bit on the tight side, and that's with the unemployment rate just above 4%. Now, in November, it had ticked up to 4.3%. But then in the December numbers that we just got recently, it dropped to 4.1. So I think the RBA's long run sort of, you know, let's use the NAIRU, as you say, is probably around 4.5%. Their own forecasts at the moment have the unemployment rate drifting up to 4.4, so a little bit below 4.5. But even then, if you look at their commentary around the forecast, they say the labour market would still be a little bit, well, the economy would still be facing capacity pressures over their forecast period. So 4.4, I think, is still a little bit below what the RBA would think is the NAIRU. So I think it's around about 4.5 in their minds. The issue at the moment is wages growth is not blowing out. You know, the wages growth is not too bad. The problem is that the productivity associated with that, or the output that workers are producing from their labour, is not especially high at the moment. And one of the issues is a lot of the growth we've had of late is in the services sector. You know, national disability, the disability care, healthcare, aged care, childcare, which are all great services, but the productivity you can generate out of those areas is not especially high. And so
How do you measure the productivity of an aged care worker? Well, I have no idea.
That is exactly the – and the ABS basically assumes little productivity. So in many areas, again, as we move to a services sector economy, you're going to get – we're getting service sector inflation that is pretty firm. And really that's the one of the underlying – housing and services inflation are really what's driving inflation at the moment. Goods inflation – it's usually pretty dormant, and broadly speaking, that's still the case. But in the services area, yeah, you've got, you know, a lot of care-related services, but even in the hospitality sector, we've had pretty firm price pressures of late.
David, I got you on the program to embarrass you, and that's to ask. That's to ask. We'll get the 60 pages of analysis from the Reserve Bank when it releases its quarterly statement along with its rates decision next week. What does this news about inflation mean it's likely to do next week and for the rest of the year? And I'm sorry to put you in that position.
Yeah, look, as they say, you're only good as your last rate call. So I got a few right last year, which I was happy about. This year, the February meeting is definitely going to be a live meeting, as they say. There's a very my base case is they will raise rates in February. I think the inflation numbers we got for the December quarter were still on too high, on the high side. My sort of line in the sand was if underlying inflation was 0.8, they would keep rates on hold. It came in at 0.9, so you know, by that criteria, I think they will go. I'm hoping it's one and done, though. I think we'll see one rate hike, some probably hawkish commentary for the RBA over the next few months. Hawkish by mean warning of potential further interest rate increases. And that may see demand moderate and some of the pricing pressure we're seeing moderate. And so, again, my base case is it's one and done.
But merely by changing direction and saying so, they may push up unemployment.
Yes.
Turn people off spending.
Yeah, I mean, the negative, you know, the headlines will be, you know, RBA warns of future rate rises. And that in and of itself, you know, can cause people to, you know, rein in their spending, adopt a more cautious outlook.
Of course, the other truism is that interest rate rises are usually like cockroaches. And you know the punchline. There's never just one of them. So this would be unusual, right?
Look, I guess the way I would characterise it, this is not the start of a new tightening cycle. If it is a new tightening cycle, there's usually more than one. They don't just raise rates once. But I think what this will be is acknowledgement that maybe one of the rate cuts that they did last year, they cut rates three times, it was probably one too many. And so they're just taking one of those back without necessarily beginning a new tightening cycle. But again, it will all depend on the inflation numbers. If the March quarter numbers that come out in late April are still on the high side, they'll have no choice but to raise rates again, probably at, say, the May policy meeting. So it really does depend on the inflation numbers and whether they start to moderate or not.
We'll have to keep watching and keep listening here on The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin. Our guest this week, former Treasury economist David Bassanese, now with Beta Shares, and Miriam Robin from the Australian Financial Review. Miriam, if someone had found out about these consumer price index figures early, before they came out at 11:30 Eastern Daylight Time on Wednesday, they could have made a lot of money. They could have placed a bet on what the result would be by buying or selling bank bills or the Australian dollar, knowing in advance what the consumer price index would do to prices. It's the stuff of movies, horse racing legends. Does this sort of thing, insider trading, still happen?
It does still happen. I suspect there's more of it happening all the time than we realise. But sometimes there is a case that breaks into the public consciousness and ends up with a criminal conviction, which is what happened this week when a man called Rodney Forrest, who's a Sydney money mover, a fund manager, he basically pled guilty. And so it didn't go to trial. I think they clearly had very good evidence and understanding of what happened, but he pled guilty and he's got sentenced to 6 years with 3 years non-parole. So that's
what did he do?
So
what has he admitted to doing?
Yeah. So it was quite brazen, really. So what he did was he was an equity analyst for the chairman of Regal, which is a big fund manager, and they were talking, and then the chairman left the room and his laptop was open, and they were actually considering a major takeover of another fund manager. So he then went around to his laptop, took some photos of the screen, and then went and bought a whole bunch of shares, made about $300,000 in profit by getting ahead of the announcement, basically, which he actually also tried to plant in the newspapers, I guess, to try and increase his financial benefit.
How does that work, by the way? They're planting in the newspapers. So you get the inside information, you buy knowing something that isn't generally known, then you tell everyone?
Yeah, well, I think he gave a tip to the, it was actually to the Street Talk column in the Australian Financial Review, which is always very well sourced, but I think they did not run the story, luckily for them. But you just give, you tell them, oh, you know, I have reason to know that this is happening, and you should write a story saying market rumour is that so-and-so is considering buying this other company.
And this would push up the price to make sure he made money even before the takeover was announced.
Yeah, exactly.
Does it happen often? Have there been many convictions?
There have not been very many convictions. So there was quite a famous and large one a few years ago of this guy called Lucas Kamei, who was a currency trader. And a mate of his actually worked at the Australian Bureau of Statistics and would basically get advance knowledge of some of those economic indicators we've been talking about, get a burner phone, go into the bathroom and text him what it was going to be. And he made currency trades to make very, very large profits. Like, I think he was over $6 million in profits. It was quite ridiculous. So that kind of thing attracts attention. And the plan had actually been to bet far, far less money and fly under the radar, but this guy got greedy. So so he got quite a lengthy 7-year sentence as well. They basically caught him because him and this guy he was communicating with, once they didn't have their burner phones. And then the evidence was they actually found the burner phone. But it actually took police a lot of work to actually figure out how he could know this information. They had a suspicion based on the profits and a tip-off that they got. But you actually have to prove that someone had advanced knowledge. And that's where there's actually not a lot of convictions on these things. And many cases have gone to court. And then there is no proof that someone had advanced knowledge of someone. So the chairman of Vocus, who's this guy called Vaughan Bowen, he actually went to court last year and they couldn't prove in court that he had advanced knowledge that a takeover was going to fall over and he sold a bunch of shares before it did. But yeah, a jury found that it was not clear that he did know. So he was not convicted. And That is really the stumbling block. And think about all the ways you can come across information. You could look over someone's shoulder on a Qantas flight. You could hear something on a barbecue. Police really need to be able to prove that you knew. And often you're the only one who knows if you did.
David, does it happen in your industry? And I ask that because there's a sort of grey area, I suppose, between what people in your job do, chief economists, guessing what the Reserve Bank should do, and knowing what it should do. And I suppose we've certainly got that case of the knowing what the Australian Bureau of Statistics will do. But do people think about this? Is this a concern? Have you ever, well, I won't ask about you, but has some of your colleagues ever tried perhaps too far, too much to find out what's going on inside the Reserve Bank?
Look, I don't think there's ever been a case of any inside information coming from the bank and anyone being convicted of that. So, you know, unlike, you know, as mentioned, there was a case where there was leaked information from the ABS, Australian Bureau of Statistics. So that's one way you can get inside information in terms of macroeconomic trading, because obviously a strong labour market report, for example, would increase the odds of the RBA raising rates, the market would move, and that's how he made his money. The Australian dollar went up if the employment report was strong. But I don't think at the moment there's been no evidence of information directly from the RBA. Now, what has tended to happen in the past, the RBA, again, this is not really insider trading. It's more signalling. You know, sometimes in the past, the RBA, particularly if the markets had a certain view of the interest rate outlook, which was quite different to what the Reserve Bank had. So maybe the market was expecting aggressive interest rate increases and the bank thought, look, they've got it wrong. We don't think that's going to be happening. And they might try to, you know, massage market expectations through a talking to a journalist who might write a report. Again, that's not inside information. The journalist is not trading on that information, at least I don't think they would be.
I have been in that situation, yeah, and I've received those calls, and yes, I have not.
There you go. But you do write the article, and yes, look, I've known again.
Even if I think I'm being used, even if I think, say, yeah, example, someone says the Reserve Bank is going to cut interest rates by an outsized amount. That's the recommendation that'll go to the meeting. I've been right before. I've told you this. Report it. I've reported it, that there's speculation that that's going to happen. It's plunged the Australian dollar. It did.
Yes.
And that advantaged that person who traded early, that advantaged that yes, firm that traded early. But I was going to report it.
Look, just quickly, I guess what has happened in the past, and a good friends of mine who were strategists like myself in the markets, you know, I knew a guy who would wake up at 4 a.m. to get the Sydney Morning Herald newspaper because, you know, there was no online in those days. He had to wait for the newspaper to come out just to see what certain journalists were saying about the Reserve Bank, because it was an early heads up. And the markets moved on those news stories back in the day. And so the first person who could read that news story and, you know, relay it to their traders stood to make money. So that's how that was, you know, what he did as part of his job.
You might be referring to a journalist called Alan Mitchell. And apparently one of the things in the Australian Financial Review, with which you've both worked, actually, was that if Alan Mitchell was on holidays, it was regarded as the Reserve Bank probably wasn't going to move. And so FinReview staff were told, if anyone asked, not to say whether or not Mitchell was. I don't know.
Yeah. Ross Gittins at the Sydney Morning Herald was another, you know, I guess, well-sourced journalist from time to time.
Go on.
I was going to say, like, there has been a massive change in that area. And one of the reasons I got rates right last year, when I think very few economists did, I think it was around July, the markets, there was a data piece came out, and the markets were thinking, you know, something about interest rates, thinking the RBA was going to cut rates. And there was no media article to suggest otherwise. So the markets blithely continued expecting a rate cut. And I actually said at the time, look, I don't think they will. And one of the reasons is there's been a change of the board. There's a lot more independent board members, and they don't want to be told what they're going to be voting for in the media, you know, a week before the meeting. And so I think, and the governor has since come out and said, the idea of, you know, backgrounding journalists is really not really going to be a feature going forward, because they can't, they've got to respect the voting members of the board to make a decision. They don't want to be told by the governor what will happen even before the meeting. So it's been a big shift in interest rate, in the way, you know, the media and markets and whatnot deal with the RBA, with the changes with the Reserve Bank board over the past year.
Things have changed, and there's also, has been for a long while, a blackout period. We're in it right now, from mid-Wednesday to when the decision is announced Tuesday, where no member of the Reserve Bank staff is allowed really to communicate with the outside world. But there's no blackout here on The Economy Stupid on Radio National. Me, Peter Martin, our guest this week, business sleuth at the Australian Financial Review, Miriam Robin, and financial markets economist David Bassanese at BetaShares. David, what just happened at the gathering of elites in Davos, Switzerland, the World Economic Forum? President Trump said he'd demand the right to take over Greenland and impose punitive tariffs on any nation that stood in his way. Then financial markets started selling US bonds and pushing up US bond rates, and the president backed down. Is that the way to describe it?
You know, one argument is that all of this posturing about Greenland and potentially, you know, not ruling out military intervention was a bargaining, you know, method of bargaining, so that he could ultimately get the deal he wanted. But I suspect it's more like he did believe these things, that he could just impose tariffs on Europe, for example. But the negative bond market and you know, equity market backlash, I think had him have a change of heart.
There's a guy, it's the guy who coined the phrase, it's the economy, stupid, James Carville, a strategist for Bill Clinton. He coined another phrase a year after Clinton became president. He said, I used to think if there was a reincarnation, I wanted to come back as the president or the pope or a champion baseball hitter. Now I want to come back as the bond market. You can intimidate everybody. Is the bond market, traders who buy and sell bonds, more powerful than anybody?
When they sort of, get up and start selling off bonds and pushing up bond yields, yeah, politicians around the world respond. There was a case in the UK only recently where they wanted to spend a lot of money, blow out the budget deficit. The bond market responded. And that Prime Minister, Liz Truss...
She lasted as long as a lettuce.
Donald Trump announced a series of tariffs last year, the Liberation Day tariffs. Markets feared it would cause a recession. But bond yields in the US actually went up because people were getting out of the US market, basically selling US assets. It was actually the bond market response that ultimately caused Donald Trump to back down. Equity market had already sold off quite a bit, but it was only once the bond market decided to sell off that he got nervous because, again, the US has a large budget deficit, it's got a lot of debt, and if interest rates went up too much, refinancing that debt would get a lot harder.
It's also the dollar. In fact, it's pushed our Australian dollar up. We're now against the US at a three-year high. We've cracked 70 US cents, up from 62 US cents at the start of last year. And Miriam, it's also the price of gold. With everything that the US president has been doing during the Davos World Economic Forum and just after, it sailed through $5,000 an ounce. Now, it was only in October, 3 months ago, that it sailed through $4,000. That means it took all of trading history to climb to 2,000, less than 2 years to climb to 4,000, 3 months to climb to 5,000. Is this good news for Australia? We make a lot of gold.
We do make a lot of gold and we export a lot of it. It's actually a really large export for Australia. So it's about 12% of Australia's exports by value. So that's less than iron ore and LNG, but ahead of coke and coal. It's good for a bunch of Australian miners, including Newmont and Evolution Mining, all of whose share prices have gone up really high. I think it's quite an interesting sort of dynamic in what it says about the global economy because, you know, we were just talking about, you know, inflation's up, unemployment's down, and gold is generally seen as a safe haven asset. It's what you buy when you're worried. And, you know, there's all these indicators on the one hand saying everything's going gangbusters, but clearly people are worried. And I think they're worried at a global level and they're also worried as consumers. We've had huge consumer take up of gold, people lining up outside ABC Bullion.
Miriam and David, thank you. Before we go, as is traditional on the program, any quick final points to leave us with?
At the moment, across much of southern Australia, there's a heat wave and it has been a pretty hot summer. I think something that is interesting and worth pondering is that there have been relatively few blackouts this summer, and that's because the whole system is soaked in rooftop solar, which does really well when it's really hot and sunny. So the grid has really changed in recent years. We have had blackouts in Victoria recently because there's just been infrastructure that's been damaged by fire. Yeah, all of those solar incentives, all of those things seem to have made an impact.
David.
Over the next few months, it's going to be a pretty tricky environment on the interest rate front. The inflation numbers have certainly not been behaving of late. There is a risk of the RBA raising rates February, and the debate will be, will that be enough? Do they need to do more?
David Bassanese, Chief Economist at BetaShares, and Miriam Robin, Senior Writer with the Australian Financial Review. Thank you both so much.
Thanks very much, Peter.
Thrilled to be back.
I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.